Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi there and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. Today I'm going to be talking a little bit about the experiences and actions of Ord Wingate, the British counterinsurgency leader in Palestine during the Arab Revolt, and his particular attitudes and outlooks on the Jews and the Arabs in Palestine during the British Mandate. Wingate, as I'm sure all military historians out there will know, was later found fame and untimely death leading the Chindits in Burma against the Japanese. Wingate's admirers in the Second World War looked upon him as being the kind of maverick, the kind of warrior required to defeat Japan in Burma. A man who replaced the kind of rather complacent and inept British officers who had presided over the disaster of the collapse of Burma. Not all their fault, admittedly, but it looked like that way at the time. His detractors saw him as reckless, willing to sacrifice men's lives, and ultimately a man who was able to embrace lost causes with a zeal. And the story of his days in Palestine are slightly less well known. They're extremely well known in Israel. He's held up in certain parts in Israel as being a kind of a national hero, even though he himself was not Jewish. And the story of Wingate really is an interesting from the point of view of the development of the State of Israel, but also from the point of view of the kind of the latter days of the British Empire. There are a number of Wingate-esque kind of figures in the 1930s, 40s and 50s who are able to use immense violence to quell national insurgencies, of which, you know, the last three decades of the British Empire are punctuated by these kinds of risings in various parts of Asia, the Middle East and Africa. Wingate has so many military and civilian bureaucrat figures of his generation across the empire was born into a colonial family in India at the turn of the century. And his parents were part of the Plymouth Brethren movement, particularly austere and radical Christian sect. The Plymouth Brethren were not alone in the first decades of the 20th century in Britain in believing in sort of this notion of dispensationalism, the idea that for the workings of the Bible, the prophecies of the Bible to be fulfilled, that the Jews must return back to the Holy Land. David Lloyd George, for example, grew up in a particular environment of Welsh Methodism that preached the same, and there were a number of luminaries within the Liberal government who could be described as Christian Zionists in the run-up to the Balfour Declaration of 1917. And if you haven't explored the Balfour Declaration, there is a podcast, I must have done it last year sometime, on this very topic that's well worth a listen, I'd say. Wingate was a Christian Zionist, somebody who passionately believed that the Jews should have a home in the Holy Land, not necessarily for the sake of the Jews themselves, but really to fulfil the work of a Christian as opposed to a Jewish God. There's generally quite a lot of nonsense talked about dispensationalism and about Christian Zionism in general. There's a very extreme version of Christian Zionism which is practiced, I think, in very small numbers. Though things like Fox News might give you reason to dispute that, where you know the idea is that if the Jews return to the Holy Land, then some kind of Armageddon will occur and the confrontation with Satan will happen, and there'll be this whole rapture type deal, and the Christ will return and that sort of thing. So it's all kind of playing the long game. Whereas for the most part, Christians ranging from Roman Catholics to Orthodoxy, Eastern Orthodoxy, to Methodism, tended not to have this kind of apocalyptic view of things, but believed that in general, this was what the return of the Jews to the Holy Land was God's will. It was a kind of a restitution of an old wrong, and that the Jews had some kind of right to be there. There may have been some sense of kind of patronizing paternalism that, you know, well, you know, perhaps once one day the Jews will come to embrace Christ by being back in the Holy Land. There was a slightly more benign view than a desire to bring on the apocalypse for most Christian Zionists. Part of the reason for this profusion in Christian Zionism or sort of philo-Semitism that existed in some of the political, bureaucratic and military circles of the 19th century was the reading of the Old Testament in schools and in Sunday school and in church, and the intimate knowledge that many people would have had of the story of Moses and the Exodus and the stories of the Jews and exile and that kind of thing. It was a kind of a powerful narrative within Anglicanism, the Methodism. And it kind of had been really since the 17th century. There are numerous appropriations of the story of the Jews by Christians in the Old and New Testaments since really probably about the 17th century, and attempts to really equate struggles within Christendom. And the language of Jerusalem of return to some sort of perfected world, some sort of utopia, some sort of idyll is frequent. And, you know, you only need to look at the way in which England is depicted, or Britain is depicted after 1945, the building of a new Jerusalem, that kind of thing. Anyway, Wingate had trained as an officer from 1921 onwards, and he was very much one of the last of a generation of British Orientalists. He had had a posting in the 1920s in Sudan. He was well connected. His cousin, Sir Francis Reginald Wingate, had previously been a Governor General of Sudan and High Commissioner of Egypt, where the British were in situ until the 1950s. And he perhaps was cut his teeth in counterinsurgency, patrolling Abyssinia during that period of time. And he starts to pioneer methods here that he later uses in Palestine and Burma of ambushes, of luring out the enemy into situations where they are almost certainly doomed. In 1936, he seconded to Palestine During the time of the Arab revolt against the British, led by the Grand Mufti of Palestine, the revolt really is in response to mass Jewish immigration into the Palestinian Mandate, and Wingate volunteers to go. He believes that he has a divinely appointed role in helping the Jewish people. And there he has a difficult time in convincing the Zionists themselves. He meets Chaim Weizmann and the other Zionists and tells them, you know, I'm a British officer here and I'm here to help. I'm here to help you fight the Arabs. Jewish Zionists are unconvinced because there are, in their view, and they're probably right in thinking this, a great number of anti-Semites amongst the British military and the British colonial classes. There seems, from the point of view of the Zionists, to be very little sympathy for the Jews and their problems. The British, by the mid-1930s, are perhaps more sympathetic towards the Arabs than they are towards the Jews. If you read James Barr's brilliant book, A Line in the Sand, which talks about the experience of the British and the French and their two mandates, the British in Palestine and the French in Syria, it is the extraordinarily violent attitudes of the French and the actions of the French towards their Arab populations that in some way bring about more a more sympathetic approach from the British, perhaps based on a kind of a mutual an antipathy and loathing for the French. The Zionist Jews find a friend of convenience in the French, as both the British and the French sought to kind of unseat one another from their two mandates within the Middle East. It's a great book anyway. The other book on the Palestinian mandate that's well worth a read is Tom Segev's One Palestine Complete, from which there is an awful lot about Wingate in there. Anyway, Wingate goes far beyond his role, his mandate, if you pardon the expression, in helping the Jews to organise themselves. He writes a report titled, on June 1938, entitled Secret Appreciation of Possibilities of Night Movements by Armed Forces of the Crown with the Object of Putting an End to Terrorism in Northern Palestine. By forces of the Crown, however, Wingate wasn't suggesting that British soldiers become involved. Instead, he planned to organise units of volunteers, almost exclusively Jewish volunteers, really, in essence, deputising armed groups of Jews to deal with the Palestinian Arab uprising. He wrote, "There's only one way to deal with the situation, to persuade the gangs that, in their predatory raids, there is every chance of their running into a government gang, which is determined to destroy them. The units would carry the offensive to the enemy. Take away his initiative and keep him off balance, and produce in their minds the belief government forces will move at night and can and will surprise them either in their villages or across the country." The level of violence that Wingate was proposing and indeed carried out was almost a template for counter-insurgency work, counter-terrorism work, which is a form of kind of a terrorism in its own right, that can be seen in subsequent operations throughout the rest of the 20th century, you know. There were American officers in Vietnam that read Wingate's work. There were Contra rebels in Nicaragua who read Wingate's work and appreciated its importance and significance. Wingate made sure that his force was based not at British Army bases, but in Jewish communities. It had a British element to it, but it became predominantly dominated by Jewish police and the Haganah, the Jewish Defence Force. The Haganah, a paramilitary organization which had been initially developed to defend the early Jewish settlers after the beginnings of the Palestine Mandate, and had become active in taking the fight to the Arabs during the Arab Revolt, were thrilled at the proposition put to them by Wingate. They'd been hoping to develop their military capability for years, and now here came the British government presenting them with arms, equipment, and a license, really, to carry out the kind of attacks that they'd always hoped for. Advantages that the Haganah brought was that they knew the land, they knew the terrain, and they had plenty of intelligence on who they believed to be the ringleaders of the Arab revolt. And Wingate acts really as the kind of the linchpin between the British and the Haganah. The British are in mutually and the Haganah are mutually suspicious of one another. Archibald Wavell, the military commander of Palestine, initially is sceptical, but then thinks that, well, he'll give it a go and try out Wingate's suggestion. The Jews do not really believe that the British have their best interests at heart. But finally, when there is an agreement, the operation is extremely effective. Wingate's groups are known as the SNS, the Special Night Squads, and Wingate reminds his men of the Jewish hero Gideon, who defeated overwhelming odds with but a small group of 300 volunteers. And Gideon is an idol, an icon for Wingate. He establishes a base and a training school at the town of Ein Harod. And he uses Ein Harod as the kind of forward command post, one of several. The SNS squads disrupt the attacks by the Mufti's insurgents, and they do this through ambushes. The prime target of the Mufti's squads was the Iraq to Haifa pipeline that had been laid by the British, and it made the port of Haifa one of the most important and strategic and indeed wealthiest ports in the Middle East, and it was the means by which the British shipped oil from the Middle East to the rest of back to Britain and to the rest of the Western world. So it's a vital artery in the British Empire. It was something of a mystery to the Jews, was Wingate. They didn't really quite understand quite where his intensity to fight for the Jews and to argue later on for mass Jewish emigration into Palestine. They had little understanding of his religious background, and so, yes, they were puzzled by him, but ultimately his zeal for the Jewish community is something that finally convinces them that he really is what he says he is, and really is an advocate of the Jews in Palestine. What he created in the Haganah really was a commando fighting force. The thing that Wingate is perhaps his greatest legacy, in a way, was to be one of the founding fathers of special force warfare in the 20th century. The Haganah, and then later the Israeli Defense Force, look upon Wingate as being, you know, the pivotal figure in their creation, and you know, admire him as such. Tom Segev, in One Palestine Complete, paints a different picture of Wingate, paints him as little more than a bloodthirsty terrorist, and the destruction of Arab villages, the execution of prisoners, and the merciless nature of Wingate's ambushes was, for him, evidence that he was a fanatic and perhaps even a war criminal. the violence on all sides, and the violent the activities of the British Army in general during the Arab Revolt are not dissimilar to the actions of Wingate, which isn't really to present a mitigation for his actions, but to show that really he wasn't necessarily his actions weren't necessarily inconsistent with what was going on in Palestine at the time across the board. There would have been British officers that didn't particularly blink at what Wingate was doing during the Arab Revolt. Wingate's downfall was his egomania. He believed that the Jews would be an excellent addition to the fighting capabilities of the British Empire, sort of akin to the Gurkhas, I suppose, in some regard. He thought that the war that was inevitably coming would mean that the Jews, as a kind of a martial warrior people in his eyes, would be a great addition to Britain's arsenal, would help Britain to keep her empire. I mean, Wingate was nothing if not an imperialist as well as a Zionist. He was an insane egotist and very opinionated. He returned to London in 1938 to lobby the British government to accept his plans and to accept a huge increase in Jews into Palestine. Now, this far, far exceeded his mandate as an army officer, and also it left his colleagues in the British Army rather scratching their heads as to what this maverick officer was really on about, what his mission was. Perhaps they viewed him as something of a T.E. Lawrence for the Jews. And the latent anti-Semitism, and the general sense that he was one who had gone native and got a bit too close to the locals, and had become a bit too much of a fanatic, really dented Wingate's career and ended his career in Palestine. And it was only during the Second World War on the Burma front that that career would be resurrected and then cut short in 1944 with a plane crash. Wingate took everything that he'd learned in Sudan and in Palestine and applied it very effectively to fighting the Japanese, even if ultimately the triumphs against the Japanese only come at the end of the war after his death, after a great deal of collateral damage. Anyway, I hope you found this useful, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thank you.